Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Welcome to another edition of the Flixwise Podcast. I'm your host, Lady P, no relation to Master P. And sitting in front of me is my loyal sidekick, Gabe Haggard. Say howdy, Gabe.
I don't know if I'm comfortable with the moniker sidekick. I mean, I feel like now it's time for me to shine. Yeah, I just, and I will try to bring something more to the table.
Yeah.
But I don't think I want you to call me a sidekick anymore.
Oh, and joining us today is yet another very special guest. It's just been a bounty of riches, hasn't it, Gabe, as far as special guests are concerned?
I'm just nervous for the time that we do the intro and you say that we just have a guest and it's not a special guest.
Yeah.
I'll feel really bad for that person.
That's
but
true.
So far, they've all been unique and special.
I know, it's amazing.
I'm thrilled to be so special.
Let's tell everyone her name.
Okay, well, this time, the guest is even more special because it's my BFF, my biffle, Julianne Martin. Say hi, Julianne.
Hello, all of you adoring fans out there.
Okay, thanks, Julianne. Julianne is here today to help us analyze the number 5 movie on the Sight and Sound Critics poll, F.W. Murnau's Sunrise, A Song of Two Humans. And as much as Julianne clearly loves her silent expressionist melodramas, I think she's probably here more for our second topic, television. That's right, we don't just watch movies here at Flixwise. From time to time, we like to discuss matters relating to the small screen. Today, we're going to specifically talk about the rise of prestige television and its impact on film. Are you guys ready?
Yes.
All right, well, hold on to your bushel of reeds.
Pretty good.
Them's rough waters ahead. For our first topic, we're going to discuss the first silent movie on the Sight and Sound list of greatest films of all time, F.W. Murnau's Sunrise, A Song of Two Humans. Sunrise was released in 1927, and it stars George O'Brien as the man and Janet Gaynor as the wife. Here's a quick synopsis. The man and the wife live a quiet, bucolic life out in the country with their infant son. At first glance, things look pretty idyllic. They've got a beautiful family, they've got lakefront property, a housekeeper. However, that is until the woman from the city enters the picture. Just as a side note, I think we can all agree that woman from the city is the greatest euphemism for dirty, wanton whore the world has ever known. Can we agree?
Yeah.
I'd like to reserve judgment, you know? She may be just a lost soul as well,
right.
You know? I mean, she stayed on for weeks and weeks even after everyone else had gone back to the city.
That's
She's
true.
Clearly an evil Jewess.
Yeah.
I'm just saying. She's
well,
she's
I mean,
clearly.
That, I'm not disputing that.
Anyway, okay, the woman from the city, it just says it all, doesn't it? Okay, so this woman from the city, she's played by Margaret Livingston, uses her magic female powers of evil to seduce this poor, innocent man away from his family. She convinces the man to ditch the kid and the old lady and move with her to the city. Knowing that the wife isn't going to take this whole adultery abandonment thing very well, the man and the harlot hatch a plan wherein the man...
we don't know that much about her.
Okay, her introduction shot is her, like, primping in front of the mirror, like, you know, checking her hair, making sure that bob looks good.
Precisely. I
and
mean,
it
to
does.
Be fair, she
oh
looks
God.
Fabulous. I think yes.
I would absolutely stray from my virtuous blonde wife for that
absolutely.
Woman.
Absolutely. Oh, my God. And the hats. I love the hats. Anyway. We digress. So the man and the harlot hatch a plan wherein the man is going to take his wife out on a boating trip where he's going to drown her and make it look like an accident. Will the man go through with this dastardly deed? Okay, spoiler warning, jump ahead to our next segment if you don't want to know what happens next. I can tell you're all on the edge of your seats. So the man totally chickens out, slash has a change of heart, seconds before he's about to toss her over. He decides that he loves his wife after all. However, though he decides not to kill her, he successfully scares the crap out of her. I guess she senses that something is amiss with her husband, and eventually she intuits his plan. This leads the man and the wife on a journey to the city, where the wife eventually comes around and forgives her husband, and they have a great night out in the town. Once the couple has blown through all of their money, they decide to call it a night. They set sail on their trusty raft and head towards home.
That's a great idea. Get back in the raft where mere hours ago he tried to murder you. But now you love each other. You got a haircut together.
So, okay, the winds, the man and the wife, they get in this boat back to home. But the winds have picked up, and the boat looks like... And the boat looks like it's about to capsize. So the man hands the wife a bushel of reeds to use as a life jacket. And eventually the boat does go under, and the couple are separated. The man finds himself washed up on the riverbank, with a lake shore. He frantically calls for his wife, but she's nowhere to be found. He climbs ashore and organizes a search party, which continues to search throughout the night. Fearing the worst after a fruitless search, the man returns home, despondent and exhausted. And who does he find is waiting for him by his doorstep?
That evil temptress vixen whore.
Why
bag?
Is our favorite floozy? Well, and naturally, she's thrilled that everything, you know, went off without a hitch. But, so now that the wife is out of the picture, she's ready for the two of them to start a life together in the city. But before she has a chance to pick out China patterns, the man starts strangling her within an inch of her life. But just before he does any permanent damage, one of the townspeople starts calling the man, announcing that they found his wife. He drops the mistress, both literally and figuratively, and rushes nice. To be by his wife's side. And he's there when she awakes. The two embrace, and the film dissolves into a sunrise. Okay.
It's sort of like the restart of their life together. They've gone.
Beautiful. Beautiful metaphor. So, Julianne, I take it you enjoyed this movie.
I loved it.
I loved it?
Every moment of it.
Gabe?
This one was harder for me than any of the others to get past the archaic nature of it.
Yeah.
How black and white it was, how, like, stilted, like, the acting was, you know, and how much of almost, like, a different medium, like, silent films are than what we're used to nowadays.
Yeah.
So it was really hard for me to kind of get into. At a certain point, I did get into it, and I think it reminded me a lot of the first 8 minutes of the movie Up.
Okay.
Just in the, like, silent storytelling. And how that can be effective and can be very powerful. Because I think at a certain point it was powerful, like when, you know, his wife is lost and blah, 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 you know, there was something very compelling and still relatable mm-hmm. about the storytelling at that point for me.
Okay.
So I did enjoy it, not to a great extent, but there were still aspects of it that I found very enjoyable.
Okay. So for me, the pleasures of watching this movie are so immediately obvious, like, and enduring. So even 90 years later, I think this movie is still visually stunning. And it, I just want to point out, won the first Oscar for cinematography. The superimpositions, the fluid camera movement, the expressive lighting, even the intertitles are really cool. But that being said, I have some issues with the story.
The story is really simplistic.
Yeah.
Like, firstly, none of the characters even have names, which I understand stories that do that and why they employ that device, but I also find it so alienating. Like, when you can't connect to a character on a first-name basis, and they're just supposed to embody this archetype of, you know, whatever their character is, I just kind of lose sympathy for them.
Yeah.
It detaches me.
Yeah, I mean, I felt about this movie like I felt kind of about something like Gravity, where it's like, I appreciate that it's amazing to look at, but you can't get too distracted by the story, because the story is, you know, something that really detracts from it. But I think Julianne's sort of getting at this in her description of the woman from the city, and I think I touched on it as well. It's the Madonna horror complex that this story is based on.
Absolutely.
And this is, you know, it's a tale as old as time. Man meets girl, man marries girl, man impregnates girl, man no longer finds girl sexually desirable, man meets another girl with dark eyeshadow, man uses girl for a while until man gets bored and returns to wife. I mean, that's a beautiful, beautiful story.
The characters, like the two women,
right.
are so one-dimensional.
Exactly.
Like, they just embody these ideas of what women should and shouldn't be, and that's it.
Exactly.
The wife is perfect. She's completely, she's not even angry that he tried to kill her. She's so selfless about it.
Yeah.
And the woman from the city is shown to have no motivation other than being base and evil.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's very hard for me to get into a story that's written on those kinds of terms.
Yeah, I think it's like this trope is so tired and sexist that I don't think that we can just overlook it despite the beautiful visuals. But Gabe, what do you think?
Well, I think some consideration in regards to that should be brought in that this was from 1927.
Right.
So, again, it's like a very different time period that they're in. And so the characters, looking at it through like the lens of our time, the characters, you know, do seem like silly and do seem, you know, like ridiculous and one-dimensional. But at that time, like the development of storytelling and film and everything, I mean, I feel like some allowance should be made for that. And so I'm not trying to defend the archetype or the way it's set up. You know, the guy's an idiot, and the girls are overly simplistic. But you know, she is upset. And again, that's why I think like in terms of trying to tell the story, they are taking a situation that is not realistic at all. He is trying to kill her at 10 a.m. and by 4 p.m. you know they're best friends again.
Yeah.
You know. But again, I think it's just trying to tell a story about a relationship and how a relationship recovers. And so I think that some allowance can be made for that.
Mm-hmm.
Although, you know, it's not to give them a free pass and maybe the way they set things up. But, you know, again, I think they're just taking archetypes to try to tell a story.
Yeah, I mean, it is set up as sort of a fable. But that being said, I don't, even despite its, you know, historical importance, I don't know if it works for me as a movie. I'm sort of hesitant to compare it to something like Birth of a Nation, where we've since, obviously, Birth of a Nation, really, really important film in terms of cinematic history. I mean, it basically invented the language that we've come to know, that we've come to use. But the themes in the film are so disturbing and so, you know, un-PC, to say the least, that we've since sort of, it's nowhere to be found on the Sight and Sound list, you know, despite its historical importance. So I'm wondering, obviously, the faults of this film are nowhere near as egregious as Birth of a Nation. How much do you think we should take in the technical achievement when assessing this movie?
I think that is generally considered very important in how movies are assessed. And so, I mean, I do think that, like, context and timing and the period is really taken into account when people evaluate works of art. Like, I was sort of thinking about that as well when I was thinking about Sunrise on my way over here. You know, how many of my criticisms are valid given that it took place, you know, it was made in 1927, but at the same time, like, there are some pretty pernicious aspects of the story that I think are worth pointing out and worth, you know, keeping in mind in spite of, you know, however great the finished product was. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think does it hold up? And I think that's important to take into account.
I really find the story to be kind of offensive in some ways. Like, I really reject the idea that this woman was the cause of him doing something so horrifying as trying to kill his wife. You
right.
know, you can't put that on another person.
Right.
That guy should be in prison.
Yeah.
He should not have a happy ending. He should not have a sunrise.
Yeah.
The sun should set on that guy.
Yeah. I mean, it's astounding to me that even people in 1927 wouldn't see that they would just accept that this guy and his wife should fall back in love. Times haven't changed that much, have they? Right? Let's focus on something positive. Right. So what's one thing we liked about this movie, Gabe?
Again, I thought the drama and, like, for the time that it was made, how it was dramatically told, you know? And for a film of that era, I felt that was really powerful. Like, when he's, you know, looking for his wife and when they're coming back, I felt that it did do a pretty good job of, like, creating drama.
Julianne, can you think of something you liked about it?
It's really dark and frank for mm-hmm. the period. It's like a really frank depiction of infidelity and, I guess some, you know, realistic challenges that come about in relationships. I think a lot of portrayals of relationships in film are so idealized And this, for, even though the story is very simple, it is, I think, a side of relationships that's rarely shown now and was certainly rarely shown years ago.
And something interesting that I may have been bringing my own sentiments to it, and so I may have been imposing like my own ideas on it. Again, it was a little hard for me to suspend my disbelief that he's going to kill her at 10, you know, and then they just get over that and their relationship is fine. But I wasn't giving him like a free pass, you know? So I was thinking, like, even though they chose to tell it in a way that wasn't fitting, you know, that he's going to kill her and then it's okay, and, you know, what a bastard, she shouldn't let him off the hook. I felt that that was just kind of the device they were using, and I did feel, first of all, that he wasn't off the hook. You know, something bad happened in their relationship, and then they, you know, made it work. And then he was sorry, and then he was, you know, contrite, and he did want to make things right. What the point of the story was, I thought was good. You know, he was going to do something bad, and then he realized that, and then he makes it up to his wife. I know. I didn't like in the end how then he goes out and tries to kill the other lady.
Right.
You know, like, that didn't work for me.
He seems to respond with violence a lot.
Yeah.
You know?
He seems like a generally horrible person.
Yeah, I mean, he's...
I actually do enjoy... I don't like that the city sequence never ends, but I did enjoy in sort of the early part of where he and the wife are in the city, there's, like, a certain desperation about them. They're, like... They're so full of adrenaline, they're so pumped, they're so passionate, and it's like they're both really hurt and upset, and they also both really love each other, and it's really intense, and I've had personal experiences like that, I can relate to that, I felt that that came across really well.
Yeah, and so I, right off the bat, I took issue with how they were going about doing it,
mm-hmm.
with the murder plan and everything, but... I think that it was a good story in a very simplistic way that, you know, if you screw up a relationship, you have to make it better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe you know, it was just too condensed because they had to have it over a span of a day.
Exactly. So it's not like whether or not you would ever or should ever rally from that. I don't even think that it was, you know, such a sexist movie. I think that it's just, you know... Because they were trying to make a you know an hour and a half film,
mm-hmm.
you know they're like, all right, well let's get these points across very dramatically in very stark contrast.
Yeah,
you know, and I think that is part of the fact you know of like filmmaking in 1927.
Yeah, but that Madonna whore complex is so prevalent prior to this film, and it continues to this day.
It sure does.
and even this man gets to have. Dimensions that the women just don't. They're either evil or they're angelic. And I think that is extremely sexist. And whether we want to, you know, if we want to hold the film accountable for the standards of today is the question. But I do think it's definitely very sexist. Some things I do want to mention. I loved the way this film looked. And I know... For this go-around, I think we all probably watched it on our computers. It really does take something away when you're just watching it on a tiny screen. I think this movie is meant to be watched on a big screen with live accompaniment.
Silent films in general are a lot better when they require so much attention. Like, this is the era where you watch movies in the background of what you're doing.
Right.
No offense, guys.
I don't. But just to be clear.
Where a lot of people do that. Or where, you know, movies for home entertainment are not your sole focus. And a silent film, by nature, requires your entire attention. And I found it very hard to give in to Sunrise, to F.W. Murnau's Song of Two
Humans.
So it
just doesn't hold up to today's attention span.
I wouldn't say that. I'm agreeing with you.
Yeah.
I think, like... If you see it in a theater, it's a completely different experience.
Right.
I mean, it's probably true of all movies, but it's especially true of a film that you've got to read.
Yeah. yeah, and to be clear, I think Julianne and I both love certain silent films. Gabe, I assume you do as well.
Mm-hmm.
Chaplin, Keaton,
yeah,
the them types. So this isn't meant to poo-poo silent film in general.
That's actually an interesting divide, because I feel like the greatest silent films are comedies, or like comedies with some degree of sentiment in them. Like City Lights is my favorite silent film, and City Lights makes me very emotional. I tend to cry at the ending, but it's not primarily a dramatic film. And you're right, like in a lot of dramatic silent films, the acting is so overly emotive and so like over the top,
yeah,
to make it. I feel like it's a much more difficult medium to convey serious drama through.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think this movie was successful in conveying the drama? I know Murnau was really hesitant to use intertitles, and they drop off as the film progresses, so you see less and less of them. But I think this film does convey the story really well. We always know exactly what's going on. It's very visual.
I guess the reason that I would say I didn't feel that it was that dramatic or it was that effective as a drama is because I really didn't like or root for any three of those characters, because the women were non-characters. They were essentially just objects or ideas that influenced the man. And the man, I felt, was horrible, a really horrible person. So I wasn't that invested either way. I was kind of like, actually, I kind of hope the wife does drown, because I'm not attached to her. She's not a real thing. I hope she drowns so that he loses out. I really want him to have a bad ending.
Yeah, I had that same impulse. I sort of hate to say it, but that it didn't feel like it would be any great loss if she died. And that way there would have been some consequence to the man.
That's,
you know?
That's the thing.
Yeah.
There was no consequence. He's tried to kill two women,
yeah,
in the span of one day.
Yeah.
And yet he deserves this great wife and his kid and his nice life. No, he doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah. Not to like pile on top of this movie, but, what did you guys think of the second act? Like, I felt like there was this really weird tonal shift once she forgives him, and it just became like this, I don't know, slapstick comedy for about 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And a very poor slapstick comedy,
yeah,
at that.
Like, some stuff was hilarious, though. Come on, when they try and fix the Nike statue that's already broken. Hilarious. Silly country bumpkins. Don't know their Greek art.
Why did they go to the city? Isn't that where all evil originates anyway?
Well, I mean, it was like, I mean, it was to show them that they, you know, not that they belong in the country, but like they had a good time, but, you know, I don't know.
Shouldn't they have retreated into a forest or something?
But didn't you see that superimposition when they finally get together? It's like they're in the forest, but they're really in traffic.
That was
so
top
dumb.
Notch. That was top notch. That was great. Walking.
That was cool. Come on now. That was cool. The visual effects are really cool.
And that's the thing. It was neat for
they're
that
cool
time
for
period.
1927.
Exactly.
I still
yeah.
think they're cool looking.
No,
I remember there's like the first shot or like one of the first shots, and it's like there's a boat, there's people and a dog, there's like a lake, but they're all different, you know,
yeah.
images on one frame, and it's like that's a pretty, you know, big achievement for that time period, and I could do that in a seconds and After Effects.
But they're walking when they're walking through the city, and it's not quite timed correctly. They're kind of walking and kind of has a little bit of a halo, you know, around mm-hmm. his head, and every once in a while, like a cutout car zooms in front of them.
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't done very well. I mean,
wow. All right.
Are you telling me that you thought that they were really there in that city during that shot? That shot was terrible.
I bought it completely.
Oh my goodness! The train is gonna hit us all. Evacuate the theater.
All right. Well, I guess we can wrap this up then. On that note, so do you guys? This movie is the number 5 movie of all time.
That is
to...
so no. No.
Not at all. Taking into consideration the historical importance of this movie.
I don't even think it's the number 5 silent film. Like, that movie, no.
Yeah. Okay. Gabe?
I'm going to say my usual thing. I think it's in the right place in the five films that we've seen.
Okay.
I expect to have stronger opinions about moving it around as we see other films.
Okay.
And expect that it may drop precipitously.
Okay.
But right now, it's certainly not better than any of the films that we've seen so far.
Okay.
Maybe better than... What was the last one?
I like it better than Rules of the Game. Yeah. I would rather watch Sunrise than Rules of the Game.
Like,
Sunrise is cool looking, I think.
A lot of its merit comes from when it was made and its place in film history. Film very early history.
Mm-hmm.
Not because it is by itself an amazing piece of work.
Okay. Fair enough. I guess I liked it better than you guys did. I do think that the visual achievement does merit a spot on this list, but I'm going to go ahead and say it definitely doesn't deserve to be number five. So, all right. that one. All right, everyone. Time to flash forward to the 21st century. So remember last year, around the summer of 2013, when there was this deluge of editorials from all these major television critics who were ready to sound cinema's death knell? Basically, there were all these think pieces and debates centered around the idea that television is now the medium that people turn to when they're in the mood for quality storytelling, and that people can no longer rely on multiplexes for compelling, thought-provoking material. So I decided to reopen that old can of worms and revisit that discussion. The reason I want to broach this topic again is because when a lot of this talk was happening, it was during the height of popcorn movie season, summer. And now, as we're recording this, we're in the middle of Oscar season, so we might have a slightly different perspective. Do we still think that the best of modern cinema is generally not as strong as the best of modern TV? I know Julian is a strong TV partisan. Gabe, I'm going to need you to stick up for movies as we discuss the advantages and disadvantages of both mediums. So, Julianne, why do you think TV is better?
Okay, well, that's a very overarching word,
yeah.
Better, but my personal preference has always been in TV. I work in TV. I work in TV animation, but it's a little bit different. But generally, the thing that I really enjoy about TV is that you spend so much time with a certain set of characters. You get to know them so well in a way that film just can't compete with. You know, you spend 2 hours in a film, and most of that, almost all of that, is going to be on plot. Like, you can have interesting characters who resonate through the ages in film, but not a character study like you can have over 80 hours, you know. I think that there are just narrative possibilities in serialized long-form storytelling on television that film just can't touch by nature of how long it is. But I mean, I'm not saying that TV is, like, universally and objectively always better than movies. Like, a great movie is a great movie. It lives on. It's immortal. It's something people care about. I just, they're different mediums, and they do have different strengths.
Mm-hmm. All right, Gabe.
I mean, I don't think this is going to be much of a fiery argument, because
yeah.
I think she really hit the nail on the head in describing them. Like, one of the opportunities that you have in television for, like, a character studies, you know, and just in a way that you don't have that available in film.
Mm-hmm.
I like films because I feel like it's the medium of storytelling. And so stories have, you know, a beginning, middle, and an end. And so that is something that predominantly you see more frequently in film. And I feel all too frequently, although not always, in television, they're more, can be more driven by the dollar. And so they're constantly leaving it open for the next episode, the next season, and so you're not getting as much of satisfaction in terms of storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And like in Mad Men, I watched, I think, 2 or 3 seasons of it, and I just got bored of the Don Draper character, because I felt like he was just constantly oscillating between like getting a little bit better, then a little bit worse, a little bit better, and a little bit worse. And at the beginning, it was compelling because it was like, you know, a compelling character. But after a while, I got the feeling, and it kind of took me out of it. It was just like, look, he's just going to, you know, start cheating on his wife again, or he's going to start doing this or start doing that, just so, you know, we might be able to have another, you know, 3 or 4 seasons.
That's an interesting point, because I tend to think that, you know, you were talking about how nowadays, like, it's a modern argument that television has eclipsed film, and I tend to think it's because films are driven by the dollar.
Right.
Film, I mean, one advantage of film is that you have these amazing budgets, so you can come up with these, like, visual feats that you'll never see on television. You'll never see them on the small screen, you know. You'll never see Titanic made for TV. But, you know, you can create these amazing effects and these really epic stories that you can't make on a TV budget. But at the same time, so many films have such bloated budgets that it's, I think, very difficult to make a film that is, like, purely creator-driven. You know, there's so much interference by studios and executives, and so much of what comes out seems really geared towards drawing a certain audience and making as much money back as they possibly can. I think people are bored of blockbuster culture. And, you know, you were saying it was popcorn season and now it's Oscar season. Like, both of those seasons leave me feeling kind of empty.
Right. But, okay, so I feel like, to a certain extent, the movies heard this call. You know, they've been hearing the talk around town that they're irrelevant, and they sort of answered. And I think 2013 was a great year for movies. We got a number of truly thought-provoking films. I loved Before Midnight. I loved, I just saw The Act of Killing, which I'll talk about later. I really liked Her. There were not Frances Ha. I really liked a number of really, like, interesting, again, character studies, or The Act of Killing was just a whole nother level. You would never see that on television. And I think that, yes, during popcorn season, there is this, I get weary. I know probably everyone in this room is sort of gets weary of these big tentpole projects that inevitably just feature a man in tights saving the world. I don't care to see any more cities destroyed, unless, of course, Joss Whedon is at the helm. I do think that there is something to be said for a story, a complete story that is told within a 1.5 to 2.5 hour time frame, or even bigger in the case of Titanic.
I agree with you. I do think there is something to be said for that, and I do think that there's some times where that's what you want. You want to see a story told in its entirety. But I think when we were talking about this before, when we were planning on this podcast, you know, I was saying, like, one thing that's so amazing to me about long-form television storytelling is you have so much room for experimentation mm-hmm. and creativity that, you know, you get 13 episodes a season or you get 20 episodes a season. You can have an episode that you can have a few episodes that deviate from the normal structure. Television just has a lot of room for creative freedom that I think can't be dismissed.
Mm-hmm. That's true, yeah. I do think that on occasion there have been instances of experimentation on television that have just really gone awry.
Totally.
and so there's also a lot of room for, like, you know, giving yourself enough rope to strangle yourself with, or whatever that expression is, you know.
One of the most divisive episodes of Breaking Bad is The Fly. It just
right,
takes place
really
in
like it.
It takes place in the super lab. Walt is obsessed with this fly. It, you know, doesn't advance the season arc along at all. It's just this isolated couple of hours with Walt and Jesse in the super lab, and some people love it and some people hate it. I'm not sure how I feel about it, but I it's not like this is a guaranteed recipe for success, but the fact that it's an option, the fact that these kinds of alternative stories can be told can produce some really amazing results.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I do think that there is something to be said for just an insular experience. Like, when you're watching a Coen Brothers movie, you're watching this movie, and it can be taken you know, as you, what you see is what you get. It's all there. It's not like wait for the next episode and then you'll get to the full picture. So I do like that. And also I do like that in film, you know, it is a director's medium. There is someone that is being held accountable for every piece of the work.
I also enjoy that, and why I would say that I enjoy the medium of film better, because I think it can be a more effective means of telling a story,
mm-hmm.
you know, because it's a more complete package. And then likewise with television, there are, you know, benefits to that. And I think a big point, it can be such a richer character study,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Television or movie?
Television.
Okay.
And you can get to know, like, so much more about the people.
See, I think you can do a really good character study within a two-hour time span or an hour-and-a-half time span. I think for me, one of the biggest pleasures of television is in a show like The Wire, where it becomes a portrait of a city. It's just on a much larger scale. So it's a number of different stories told through, you know, through a set of characters. Or recently, Orange is the New Black is another show that I really love, where, you know, we have this Trojan horse that enters a prison, and throughout the first season, we get a number of different character studies all told, you know, usually these character studies take about 20 minutes each. So I think television really shines in that respect.
When I think of the characters of, like, say, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, they feel real to me.
Yeah.
Like, I know what they would say, I know how they would respond to situations, and that's as a result of having watched them go through a ton of experiences together, and I've been on fly on the wall for all of them.
Yeah.
They're like my friends.
I think, I just want to note, we've gotten like 20 minutes into this conversation without mentioning Buffy, and I think that is a crying shame, because it should have really been brought up within the first 5 minutes.
I didn't
want to
say anything,
yeah.
Pauline.
So sorry. We should point out to our listeners, I think Buffy is the greatest show ever made. Julianne, I know it's up there for you as well, right?
Oh, I'm sorry. Who introduced you to Buffy?
Gabe?
It's up there for me as well.
I've seen a couple episodes.
Okay. Well, what's your favorite show? Do you have one?
Probably Breaking Bad.
Wow. Okay.
And again, because what I really enjoy is storytelling.
Okay.
And sort of the closing of the circle, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with a lot of other television, I feel like it just goes on, tends to go on and on.
Yeah. That is one thing I wanted to talk about with regards to television. I do think that with Breaking Bad, they did a good job of, the plotting was really well done in that show. So it did feel like, it felt like they knew where they were going. Whether they actually did or not, I don't know. I can't speak to that.
Conversely, you can get a show like Lost.
Precisely. Really. That's the other thing where I wanted to talk about. So I feel like with a television show, where you are devoting so much more time to the story and the characters, I feel like there is more pressure to stick the landing, so to speak. Because not only have you spent a lot of time watching it, you've spent a lot of time thinking about the show, mm-hmm. Especially with Lost. So, but whereas a movie, there are a number of examples of movies that, for one reason or another, they had to change the ending, particularly during the Hays Code. I'm thinking of movies like Mildred Pierce or Gilda, where for one reason or another, you know, the Hays Code would prevent the protagonist from seeming to be a bad guy, so they have to sort of be, you know, rinse clean of all their wrongdoings, and they end up back with their men. I can sort of ignore that because I know that that was tacked on, and I've only spent, you know, an hour and a half with them. It's okay. However, when you're dealing with something you've spent 40-plus hours, probably even more.
You're fine-tuned. Like, the end of Buffy, the finale of Buffy, there's a certain action that our characters go through that is so out of character, mm. and it just, it's like, you know.
That
you know
is so frustrating wrong. About film. I'm sorry, about television. When that happens, when like I've been watching for 4 seasons, they would not do that.
Yeah.
And that can be like really, really frustrating.
Right. Really frustrating. Yeah. I wanted to counter to the criticism that television can be meandering in its storytelling. If you're talking about a show like Lost, fuck you, Damon Lindelof. If you're
that's one Julianne.
I'm sorry, PG-13, everyone. If you're talking about a show like Lost, yes, it's egregious and horrible, and those writers should be strung up and tarred and feathered. But if you're talking about a show where the writers know what they're doing, like, I actually really, really like Mad Men a lot. I didn't like it in the earlier seasons. I did think it was kind of boring in seasons, like, 1 through 3. And then things got interesting in season 4, because in season 4, spoiler alert, Don and Betty divorce, and he is shown what he's like, you know, with his perfect life, like, crumbled around him. And I think they're on season, going into season 7 soon, and I realized that all of those characters feel very realistically where they would be 7 years later, which is a unique feat to me. Like, I can't think of another show that has told that kind of long-form story in a way that feels real, and really feels like all of the characters are different from who they were when we first met them, but not through, you know, any dramatic means, like having tried to murder their wives. Like, they are actually, they've actually gone through what life has thrown at them, and it's changed them, and that's how real life is. I feel that television can mimic real life or speak to real life in some ways, in stronger ways than film can sometimes. Not all the time. Some of them.
Okay. A lot of this discussion last year was brought about by the release of a book called Difficult Men by Brett Martin. And it chronicles the rise of HBO and AMC, particularly shows like The Sopranos, The Wire, Mad Men, and Breaking Bad. And it goes out of its way to dismiss shows like Sex and the City. So I wanted to sort of talk about whether there's room for women in this this revolution.
Well, that's an interesting thing to bring up. There's in a lot of these shows, one of the really most troubling aspects is that the female characters are either being portrayed unsympathetically, or there's just major fan backlash against them, against Betty Draper, against Skylar White, against I've never
Carmela
seen
Carmela Soprano, I think it was.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. But yeah, it's like these men, you know, in the case of Breaking Bad, Walter White, he's a serial killer. He murders multiple people. He is the worst human being. He, like, turns Jesse into his personal, you know, piece of clay that he's molding to shape his purposes. Skylar just responds in a lot of ways that I feel is natural. I remember reading on the Breaking Bad subreddit that someone was calling Skylar a bitch yet again because she had cheated on Walt with Ted Beneke after she tried to divorce him and he wouldn't sign the papers and he was essentially holding her hostage in this sham marriage after he had started cooking methamphetamines, after he...
Spoiler alert, come on!
After he had betrayed and violated all trust within the marriage, and they were like, she's such a bitch, she cheated on Walt. And I was like, what kind of a skewed, horrifying, misogynistic, bizarro world are you living in, man? But unfortunately, it seems like there are a lot of them out there.
Yeah. Well, I think one really important thing to realize, and this kind of goes for, like, all walks of life, like, never read the comments online. I think that's like a whole nother, like a whole nother can of
that's
worms.
That's true. Okay.
But like, I would say that it is very troubling how people react to shows. You know, like somebody watching Breaking Bad that is like worshiping or like deifying Walter, you know, and like condemning Skyler, like that's awful. And that I think is a very very uneducated and very simplistic and very ridiculous point of view.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that gets into, I mean, what can be sort of the negative and the positive of filmmaking or storytelling of any kind, whether television or film, when you get into, like, nuances of character, it can leave some people in the dust. And so there's no accounting for stupidity on the internet.
That's a good point.
You know?
It is limitless, it seems. But, okay, so...
But to dismiss, I mean, going back to what you were saying earlier, to dismiss, you know, the achievements of Sex and the City. Like, Sex and the City has a lot of problems and is very troubling, and I feel like I would have been a lot more comfortable making these kinds of arguments before the movies came out.
Right.
But, like, Sex and the City was a really important show. There had never been anything like that on television before. There had never been depictions of women who... you know, had this kind of command over their own lives that fell outside of traditional gender norms. And I think to dismiss that is sad.
Yeah. It's not fair. It's not as though, you know, The Sopranos or Breaking Bad or Mad Men are perfect shows either. But they are about men. I mean, that's... Brett Martin makes a point of saying that. These are shows about masculinity, about manhood. And that seems to be a pretty prevalent theme in these prestige television shows. I can answer my own question. I think recently I've been watching a lot of shows that feature women as the lead, the protagonist. As I mentioned before, Orange is the New Black. I love that show. I thought it was terrific. And The Good Wife I've been watching, as I mentioned on a previous podcast. Again, really, really great storytelling there. So, yes, I do think that increasingly, and I do want to point out that the Orange is the New Black, the showrunner is Jenji Cohen, and The Good Wife, you know, there is a female showrunner along with a male showrunner.
I also think we would be remiss to not include a certain, what some consider to be a sequel to Sex and the City, which is Girls, the HBO show Girls.
Yes.
I'm a fan. Okay. Anyway, continue.
Okay. And I definitely appreciate that... with the current television landscape, there seems to be room for more female voices, as well as what we've come to know and love. And, you know, Mad Men will be back. And
those
I'm sure
wonderful
that...
men.
Oh, good.
And watch that John Hamm all day long.
I know. So finally, I want to talk about Netflix and Hulu. So what impact do you guys think that's had on television?
Oh my god, Netflix is where it's at. Everyone should watch all Netflix original content, because I'm working on a Netflix original show right now.
Show off.
I think it's great. One negative thing I think it's doing, I think it's like ruining not our attention spans, but our ability, our patience.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, you can't handle like watching anything with commercials and anything like episodic television is like done.
Yeah.
I have to like control myself and wait until I can watch at least 10 episodes at once.
Exactly. But so I think maybe one of the biggest like impacts that Netflix or Hulu has had is that, you know, prior to these things, or DVR, I feel like television was meant to be more ephemeral or, like, have a shorter shelf life. Like, either you saw it on air or you didn't. But now that we have things like HBO Go and DVR and Hulu Plus and Netflix, these things are meant to last now. And do you think maybe producers and network executives and showrunners are taking that into account as they're creating these shows? Like, these may have to endure, because we can maybe sell it on the back end.
Well, I mean, I think that's one significant area, is that they're already almost looking to that as a source of revenue. Several shows, I don't remember which ones, but have even relied on deals with, say, Amazon Prime to fund the show itself. You know, and so I think, like, even the shows like House of Cards, et cetera, and like the Netflix original, they're starting to be made with that in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And like the entire, fourth season of Arrested Development was totally tailored to that sensibility that, look, people are going to be binge-watching this. They're going to sit down and watch the entire season in a 24-hour span.
Right. I guess we can wrap this up now, but...
We got a stew going, girl.
So I think that the initial debate that we started off this segment with, TV versus television, I think we can all kind of agree it's pretty silly and that there's room for both. Yes?
No. Absolutely.
Nope.
Only one.
Nope. Before we say goodbye, we just want to make sure that we end the show on a positive note, get that bad taste of our sunrise debate out of our mouth. And let's go around the table and talk about one thing that we've been enjoying lately. So, Gabe, do you want to start us off?
Yes. Last night, I went to see Cirque du Soleil at the Santa Monica Pier.
Oh, yeah?
And by the time this hits the airwaves, the show may be out of town.
Probably.
And for all our, you know, throngs of listeners all over the country, nay, all over the world, they may not have this opportunity.
Oh, there'll be a Cirque du Soleil coming soon near you, trust me.
But, yeah, I just, the shows are so amazing. I love it.
All right. Julianne?
Oh, gosh, goodness gracious me. Well, firstly, Netflix original series. I just got
Orange is the New Black, huh?
Got to encourage you all to get on Netflix and watch those original series. God bless Netflix. Again, my show is BoJack Horseman. Will be out next year. Well, I've been watching Ugly Americans lately.
Okay.
Which is hilarious. It was a show on Comedy Central that ran from 2010 to 2012, but that's okay. With Hulu Plus, I can watch it at any time, like right now.
Okay, so, but are you allowed to watch Hulu Plus, seeing as you work for Netflix Original?
I don't work directly for Netflix. I work for a production company that works for Netflix.
Okay. Duh, Gabe.
And
I mean,
also,
I would just like read the fine print. I don't know if you're allowed to.
Anyway, Ugly Americans is very, very funny, and I wish they would bring it back. If you ever wondered what the life of a social worker would be like in a New York City plagued by monsters and demons and weirdo creatures, it's pretty great.
All right, and you can catch that on Hulu Plus. So for mine, I have two. One is The Act of Killing. I mentioned it in a previous segment.
That sounds very positive.
I know. So it's because it is so bleak. It's so well made, but it is so upsetting. I thought I would include another thing that's positive. I watched Her, and I'm just really
no spoilers.
Okay. All right. No spoilers. But just really small spoiler. I'm really excited for in the near future, I'm going to be able to afford a great loft apartment with my salary at an internet startup company. So I'm really looking forward to that. It's going to be great. So yeah.
My goodness, it's like we're floating on air now.
Don't you guys just feel so happy?
The positive buzz.
I've got so much good vibes.
I feel like the rainbows are coming out of my eyeballs.
And that's the way we frame it, FlixWise, that is. Come join our discussion on our webpage, FlixWise.com. We would love to hear from you on any of our topics we discussed today. Make sure to tune in next week for our discussion of Stanley Kubrick's 2001, A Space Odyssey. On behalf of Gabe, Julianne, and myself, I just want to say thank you so much for listening. Auf Wiedersehen.
Thank you so, so much.
Thank you.